your planes are looking for disruptions to bomb, so you camouflage your anti-camouflaging to disrupt the webcam, which is like an aerial surveillance. Just a thought.
Linda, maybe if you use the mic, or Gavin. Yeah. It's on.
It's on?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, potentially. I mean, I think one of the other important things to sort of keep in mind is that the notion of camouflage and the way in which facades are treated, there are a practice in Melbourne Lions Architects, who also have employed a repetitive pattern across the screen, across the building as a screen. And the points made by Michael Ostwald that camouflage is not about sort of the erasure of the element, but just to lose a sense of the definition of the edge. So in that way, I think that it's still an act of camouflage, but camouflage can also stand out at the same time. It's about the edge condition.
Can I just add to that? Just apropos of that some of the work I'm doing at the moment is actually investigating more of technical aspects of cameras, and one of those is diffraction, and therefore surely ultimately it's the architect's role to make choices around whether something is visible or invisible. In fact, obviously it could be invisible. In fact, diffraction suggests that you could make a building completely invisible. So it's about the architect's choice ultimately.
Great. I think we have another question over here and up the front as well. So just over here. Thanks, Ruben.
I'm Anne-Ring Petersen. I'm from the University of Copenhagen, and I'm one of the speakers tomorrow. I have a question for Katty Cleland and Mitchell Whitelaw. You both gave some very thought-provoking talks, and it was very interesting to see all the examples that you showed of artists using digital technologies to expand the range of expression. This was quite new works for me. I've never seen them before, but it seemed to me that there was quite a lot of fascination with the technology in that, and there was quite a lot of energy going into simply exploring technology. So I would like to ask you, what is the critical potential of these works? Could you expand on that?
That's a very good
question.
Thanks,
Kathy.
For me, these works have a critical potential, which maybe my view is relatively narrow, which is within the context of media arts practice itself, in that the work that I'm interested in, to the extent that it's pulling against a whole stack of representational conventions and practices in mainstream media and media arts, I think it does have critical potential. So it's just to do with an interest in kind of reactivating a more grounded kind of embedded encounter with the work, and maybe those are things which are actually completely prosaic and taken for granted in mainstream visual arts practice, but which are strangely esoteric in the media arts. Maybe that's the critical potential there. Otherwise, I think the critical potential for me is probably to do with the kind of tinkering that I alluded to, which is that these works represent a kind of a level of a sort of technological literacy which involves artists having the ability to take apart and reassemble technologies in ways that mainstream providers or designers of technology don't. If there's a utopian kind of potential there, then it's the idea that instead of treating technology as a kind of problematic, or deterministic force, just treat it as another material to work with, and realise your own crazy utopian visions with it.
I'm not sure, Kathy, if you wanted to.
Yeah, no, I will. I mean, I think artists have always sort of played around with new technologies, and I guess with some of the examples that I was showing and the artist's work in particular, I'm sort of curious in the way that artists envisage the possibilities of new technologies that is quite sort of different from maybe scientists or marketers or other technologists. And I think, like, that poor Grandjean piece, which I was showing, like, trying to almost generate a sense of empathy for a robot and, you know, a robot's eye view of the world, I think is quite interesting. But again, I don't think that there is anything in some ways completely new in what artists are doing with new technologies. I think it's always been the case. And I was really fascinated with Mitchell's talk and sort of talking about the disappearance of the screen. And I remember reading Lev Manovich's sort of discussion of the disappearance of the screen into virtual reality or to, you know, into the retina or into a proliferation of, you know, multiple screens, but sort of thinking he's kind of missed the whole history of installation art. And, like, you know, the screen has already disappeared. And, you know, thinking about, you know, wonderful artists like Anthony McKell and, like, you know, his light works, or, I mean, some of the ones Mitchell was showing, or Jim Campbell. Like, you know, there are so many examples of, you know, artists who kind of span, I guess, a number of different media forms. So I think a lot of the time, artists who are working with very new technologies do get a bit sort of tarred with the brush that you are just playing with a new toy. But I think playing with new toys is something artists have always done, and, you know, what they come up with can be very, you know, interesting and a very sort of different way of looking at it than some of the more consumerist corporate agendas.
Okay, thanks very much, Anne. Did you have another comment that you wanted to make?
Oh, yes, actually. I thought perhaps we need some new terms for what kind of criticism is being developed in this kind of work, because I don't want to say that they're not doing anything new and it's not interesting or anything like that. It's just that somehow when you come from sort of the mainstream art scene and then and know something about installation art, then you're a bit puzzled when seeing these works, because somehow it seems familiar. So it could be very interesting to sort of, if somebody would try to explore and try to define in which way these works are critical.
Yeah, I mean, and just in terms of context also, I think increasingly new media art scholars are sort of looking at comparing what's going on now with earlier time periods. There's a lot of sort of work going on in that area. And again, when I was listening to Mitchell's talk, I was sort of thinking about, I guess, related areas like sort of, you know, gunning sort of theatre of attractions and sort of, like, you know, and we were looking, Oren was sort of showing us babies and incubators and the whole sort of, you know, fun fair, science fair attractions, and there's a lot of sort of interesting parallels and sort of commonalities with work across, you know, all sorts of terrains, not just art.
Great. We do have time for a couple more questions before we go to tea break, so tea break's coming very soon. I'm going to do Mike at the back first, actually, Paul. Thank you.
Nipping back to the camouflage as well. Moving away from trying to conceal something in the generality of the ocean towards the specificity of a ship at sea, and the dazzle camouflage that we used in warships, which were not about concealing the object, but actually providing the illusion of movement, so that it became an impossible object on the horizon or at a distance to be able to determine its speed or direction. I don't know whether this is something that you're looking at, the sense of introducing movement using the kind of patterns that you're investigating into the built environment.
The dazzle pattern was very popular in at RMIT in the architecture school probably mid to late 1990s. So it's sort of it's hard to sort of reflect upon, I guess, what we're doing, because in some ways that was sort of seen as passe. I guess one of the things I want to sort of just not say it didn't have value. I'm just saying that it sort of became formalized in so many ways through student architectural projects that it sort of loses its currency through its repetition and usage. It's interesting that the conversation is about camouflage today, and I don't know whether I really think, and I haven't really spoken to Linda about this, I guess, but I don't really sort of see it as an act of camouflage, but in fact an act of disruption. Having said that, then the points you raise about the dazzle pattern in particular and the movement of the camera in the case of Linda's project specifically is something that we've also been starting to think about as well. And certainly the way in which a facade element might start to actually deal with changing resolutions depending on whether you're zooming in and out as well. So we are starting to think about movement, but definitely within sort of the movement of the apparatus itself rather than the building. Did you want to add?
And I think Jens has a question. Do we have? Can we get the mic quickly to Jens? Fantastic.
That would be a question for Mitchell. I was quite happy that Cathy already brought up the Anthony McCall installations from the late 60s and 70s, where a 60 mil projector was being used in order to provide exactly this post-screen-like aesthetics. Mm. I was wondering whether it comes down to art in the edge of the glowing rectangles, in how far it is the screen itself, or how what is produced in its very specific materiality and mediality for a screen and different epochs that makes it different. In other terms, in how far would you extend the purpose to go from a screen-based to a post-screen-based art, for example, in relationship to what cinema apparatuses have become in expanded cinema, or in how far this the frame of the painting was deconstructed. Mm. And how far do you think that there is a new element just by updating digitally a kind of new technology through it?
It's a limited game, no question. I mean, what I think the work that I was interested in is playing out is kind of the decomposition of the screen. And of course, once it's decomposed, you know, you can't really take it any further. But they're imitating the formal attributes of the screen, you know, the fact that it has elements and the elements are addressable. And they're just kind of bending those as far as they can go. And of course, once it's abject, once it's completely formless, then, you know, it's not a screen anymore. And so I guess then you have a completely expanded field and you do whatever you want. That's fine. But yeah, I guess I was just struck by this genre of works, which does seem to be just playing out this steady kind of pulling apart. In that sense, I think that projection mapping, which is a newer kind of practice to me, is kind of interesting because it's actually using all of the same technical languages of the screen, and it benefits from all of those same technical languages, but it actually just bends them around a sort of specific instance in a kind of interesting way. And also uses all kinds of other representational tools like 3D modelling and, you know, optics and all these very elaborate technical kind of apparati, but it turns them towards the specific rather than towards the general. But you're right, it's not a... it's an end game, I think, yeah.
We've got time for two last questions and then we'll break for tea. There's Rob at the back and then Paul Thomas has been waiting patiently. No, so, Rob...
So it's another question for Mitchell. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the alternative path through the screen landscape from the early cathode ray tube points of light that were scanning around the screen to produce lines on the screen rather than addressing pixels, which seems to be picked up by UVA's work with the lasers in the space. And also, I was also reminded of the robots that recently took over Trafalgar Square that could write your name in lights there. There seems to be another trajectory that maybe got skipped over in the living room, but is still screen-based or has been screen-based and is returning, and maybe it's returning much more in a sort of tinkered way, but still has it seems to be a strong thread through the screen, if you like.
Do you, I mean, I agree with you that there's a vector, there's a kind of vector trajectory, which is, yeah, so from the oscilloscope, and of course, so, you know, Robin Fox's work is exactly that. You know, movement from oscilloscope originally to pixels, to the reprojected video, but then now he's just moved into raw light, you know, into laser in space. And, you know, works like Noirgevert and all the other kind of laser-based, you know, writing projects. So, yeah, there's definitely that vector rather than a raster display kind of line. Is that what you meant, though?
Yeah, I think it was about your point about the homogenization of the pixels and that not necessarily being the only trajectory that we've seen in terms of the screen. Yes, we've seen it decomposed into, say, lines or in other ways of decomposing it, but it hasn't always just been this homogenous unit of the pixel, and I just wonder whether that's another arc through your transmaterial space of screens and that might be interesting to follow.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. I reckon that, I mean, I'm interested in pixels because they very explicitly reference the digital screen, and of course the digital screen is the glowing rectangle. It's the ubiquitous paradigm. So I guess I'm focusing on those, but I'm sure there are others as well. Yeah.
A Okay, Paul, did you have something you wanted to contribute? No. Okay, we can do one last question
right.
Instead of Paul's.
Well, this is quite a broad question, but I want to try it. But so, for example, next year's Venice Biennale, they have announced the title being Illumination, and we are now looking at like new ways of understanding light. For example, here, especially with Mitchell's, a lot of examples here, and now we look back to the title, new strategy or transdisciplinary strategies for art beyond new media. So, going back to traditional form of arts and visual arts, how do we see this new genre of media arts and understanding of light going back to something more traditional? Like, what would we foresee for the next Venice Biennale?
So it's a broad question to anyone.
It's
on
quite
the
broad.
I'm not sure who wants to take that one.
I don't know what we're going to see in the Venice Biennale, but it's a great theme. I think for me, because light isn't particularly a new media form, and different things can happen with light once it's, there are sort of computer-generated forms and triggering and links with sound, as Mitchell was talking about. But I kind of like sort of going back to sort of like really early, I guess almost sort of magical phantasmagoria and that sort of aspect of light. And I was sort of thinking about when we were talking about camouflage and shape-shifting on buildings and this amazing projection mapping that's starting to go on, where sort of buildings take on new lives. And again, it's a bit like the amusement park, or the sort of theatre of curiosities. It's going back to that terrain of sort of creating these kind of quite magical sort of things, not just purely, I think, things in the visual art domain, but things that are kind of public spectacles and entertainment in a good way, in a very good way.
Yeah, I agree. And I just make the quick and interesting observation that several of the works that I showed were produced by commercial advertising agencies for very large corporate clients. The aesthetic kind of movement that I was trying to identify is in no sense a sort of art world thing. It's visual culture, and it's, red in tooth and claw, as the saying goes. Like, there's no... We can't pretend that there's any kind of, esoteric, value to this phenomena. This is mass visual culture, and I reckon light is, it's probably already happened. Really, it's definitely very hot right now, and and the art world doesn't have an exclusive sort of line on that.
So I think that's probably a good way to summarise. Light is very hot right now. The tea is also very hot. Can we come back at 4:10, so you get a little bit of extra time for the final session before we do the drinks and the Roy Ascot affair later on. So you could all join me in thanking the speakers for this afternoon.